President Grimes was nearly killed by these terrorists sickens me. We need a leader in Russia who will stamp out this aggression before it spreads. Vasily Andreyanov has devoted his life to providing aid to the most impoverished countries in the world, and he understands the geopolitical struggles of our time. The United States and the broader international community should support immediate elections in Russia. Andreyanov would be a key U.S. partner in Moscow, and together, the United States and Russia can defeat Islamic extremism wherever it appears. The host of Morning Edition turned to Senator Bowles, who sat flanking her Senate colleague at the news desk with her hands folded in front of her. "This is a rare issue on which the senator from Wisconsin and I can agree," she began. "Though I don't share his characterization of the many peace-loving Muslims in places like Chechnya and Syria, I do believe that Vasily Andreyanov would be a natural choice to lead Russia in this time of crisis. The achievements of Mr. Andreyanov's foundation speak for themselves, and he would be a steady hand to stabilize the unrest that is seizing his country. His leadership would help stop the spread of toxic nationalism in Ukraine and help bridge the divide between Russia and the United States, as well as the European Union."
"Well," the host responded, "when two leaders of our highly partisan Congress can agree on something like this, the world should take note." As pictures of a presidential-looking Vasily Andreyanov filled the screen, Reese press-checked his SIG and deliberately placed it into the holster on his belt. Stuart McGovern smiled as he watched the monitor backstage in the green room. Both senators had delivered their talking points perfectly, and Stanton was even sounding presidential on foreign affairs. If he could actually get Andreyanov elected president of Russia, he would turn his greatest client into his most lucrative financial asset. Every U.S. company wishing to build a business relationship with Russia and its vast natural resources would have to hire his law firm to make the deal. He would be the de facto trade minister of Russia. Maybe he would buy that house in Aspen that his wife had suggested they add to their growing list of properties. Chapter 90. Beaufort National Cemetery, Port Royal Island, South Carolina, October. The service had been solemn, but at times humorous, as the pastor honored the life of Senior Chief Petty Officer Frederick Alfred Strain, retired. It was obvious that the man knew him well, despite Freddie having moved to Beaufort just a few months earlier. Reese figured this must have been Joni's congregation growing up. The church was crowded with family and friends, as well as former and active SEALs. The media stayed away. None of them had yet made the connection between the attempt on the U.S. president and a local veteran's funeral. Reese rode in the limousine at Joni's request as the procession made the short trip to the nearby veteran's cemetery. It was a beautiful spot in South Carolina's low country. Live oaks dripping in moss shaded the graves of soldiers who had fought on both sides of the nation's bloody Civil War and every conflict since. Freddie would rest, surrounded by fellow warriors. Reese helped Joni out of the limo and gazed upon the line of cars parked along the cemetery's asphalt driveway. A supercharged Range Rover with a custom flat black paint scheme and green Vermont plates caught his eye. The door opened, and a tall, fit man wearing a dark suit emerged. His eyes found Reese within seconds, and even at 100 yards, Reese recognized Rafe Hastings. At the graveside ceremony, before military honors were rendered, the pastor read a passage from Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8. To some in attendance, it had a special significance.
"Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?' And I said, 'Here am I. Send me.'"
Vic Rodriguez presented Joni with the folded American flag,
and the seals in attendance lined up to press their golden tridents into the mahogany veneer of their brother's casket. Rhys joined the line of frogmen, reaching into his pocket to run his thumb over the insignia that represented the Brotherhood. Superimposed over an anchor signifying the naval service were a trident spear, an eagle with its head down searching for prey, and a musket that was cocked and ready for war. Those symbols represented the three mediums in which seals operate: sea, air, and land. For a moment, Freddy's casket was replaced with that of Rhys's wife and daughter, his teammates lining up to render similar honors. Rhys closed his eyes, then opened them and looked at Joni, her arms around two of her three children, a daughter just shy of her teen years, and 7-year-old Fred Jr., providing them comfort and support. Sam could not attend due to his genetic condition and was at home with a caretaker provided by the church. Rhys removed the protective backings from his trident and placed it on the coffin. He looked back to Joni, then at the casket that held his friend, before slamming his fist down onto the Navy SEAL trident and cementing it into the mahogany, his dark sunglasses concealing his pain. As Rhys passed the grieving widow, little Fred Jr. pushed himself off his chair and stood before the coffin. Then, standing at attention, he slowly lifted his hand in salute. He remained standing until the last trident was embedded in its final resting place. There was not a dry eye in attendance. At the conclusion of the ceremony, the assembled parties gathered into groups of friends and loved ones. Soon the team guys would find an Irish pub and give Freddy a proper send-off. The local sheriff's office was informed of the commando's death and had offered to drive any of the SEALs where they needed to go, no questions asked. Rhys offered condolences to Strain's parents, whom he'd met years before, and stood uncomfortably between the groups, not feeling particularly at home among any of them. He was all too aware of the toxic environment created by some of the senior officers. The late Admiral Pilsner still had some friends in high places, and Rhys didn't want to put any of the active duty SEALs in a bad position, with rumors of them being too chummy with the man who had blown the Admiral into tiny bits in his own office. Rhys felt a hand on his shoulder and turned to see Vic Rodriguez.
"Thanks for being there for Joni and the kids, Vic. Freddy was one of my guys. I brought him in. You're one of mine, too, Rhys. We can talk about that later. I owe you a thank you, though. I got the Queen's check. Didn't think you guys would actually follow through with that. I told you it was part of the deal. Regardless of what you may think, Rhys, even in the intelligence business, our word is our bond."
Rhys nodded.
"I'm still working on the travel records for Gray and Andrenov. I should have it soon."
"Thanks, Vic," he said, turning to leave.
"There's one more thing, Rhys. After you left my office the other day, I asked myself, what would my father do?"
"What do you mean?" Rhys asked, remembering the Bay of Pigs photo on Vic's office wall. Rodriguez pulled a manila envelope from his jacket pocket, handed it to Rhys, nodded, and walked away. Rhys peered into the envelope and saw part of an aerial photo.
"What the?"
He took a few steps away from the other mourners and looked at the contents of the envelope. Maps, photos, surveillance logs, and a flash drive. It was a target package. Distracted by the package, he almost didn't see Rafe approach. Unlike the suit that Rhys had bought at a local men's store the day before, Rafe's was finely tailored and likely cost 10 times as much. His skin was tanned to a deep copper, making the scar on his face all the more noticeable. His sandy blonde hair looked sun-bleached from living in the elements. It was the eyes, though, that set Rafe apart. Those glowing green eyes. If he hadn't opted to spend his life as a frogman, rancher, and businessman, he could have gone to Hollywood. Rhys shoved the envelope into his jacket pocket and extended his hand to his friend.
"Sad day, Rhys."
"It is, brother."
"Were you with him?"
"I was,"
Rhys confirmed.
"But I didn't see it. Sniper got him."
We were in Odessa. He saved the president's life. Figured that was it. Timing was too close.
Reese hesitated.
Thank you for what you did for me.
I owed you one.
Well, not anymore.
I thought a lot about that on the boat and about what's important.
I have two, Reese.
I don't blame you for anything that went down in Iraq. I want you to know that I was angry at the system and, truth be told, angry with myself.
Reese looked at his friend and knew it was best not to push.
I spoke to Uncle Rich, Rafe said, changing subjects.
He sends his best.
He says that you saved Solomon's life, and that's what blew your cover.
You're a good oak, Reese, you always were.
Rafe broke into a rare smile as the men shook hands.
Freddy told me what your family did for Sam. Incredible!
Rafe nodded.
It was the least I could do.
Reese thought for a moment.
I have a question for you. Do you miss it?
Rafe thought for a moment before responding.
Not the action. The mission. I miss the mission.
How would you like to avenge the deaths of both Freddy and your aunt? Reese asked, bringing up the airline shoot-down he'd learned about in Mozambique.
Two birds with one stone.
How do you know about that?
Ah, the PHs, they talk too much.
That Strela 2 that brought down her airplane, the guy that supplied that missile, is the mastermind behind President Zubarov's assassination and Freddy's death. Rafe turned his green eyes toward the gravestones and then back to Reese.
When do we leave?
Chapter 91. Buenos Aires, Argentina, November. Oliver Gray loved Buenos Aires. It was so alive. It reminded him of Madrid, with its rich history and old-world architecture, but there was a spark here that Europe lacked. Spain's best days were behind her, but this nation had a bright future. San Telmo was not his favorite part of the city, but thanks to its Russian population, it was the safest place for him until things settled down. He would have loved to have explored his old neighborhood of Yuncal, but the chances of being spotted there by someone from the U.S. Embassy were too great. This working-class neighborhood was home to a group of Russian expatriates to which, of course, Andrinov's network was connected. Gray was to go to ground until the next phase of the operation unfolded. Once the inevitable elections were held, Gray would take his place at Andrinov's side in Russia. He got a taste of his future home each day when he looked to the bright indigo domes of the Cathedral of the Most Holy Trinity, shrine to the Russian Orthodox religion that Andrinov loved so deeply. Perhaps Gray himself would attend services there as part of his transformation. He took a bite of the Milanesa and washed it down with half a glass of the House Malbec, his third. The hearty meal made him crave a smoke, and he thought of the fresh supply of local flu-cured leaf that he'd bought for his pipe that morning. The operation had been a success, despite the escape of the U.S. president and the thwarted chemical attack. The linchpin of the entire plan was the assassination of President Zubarov and the subsequent blame game. Zubarov was lying in state in Moscow, and the international media was whipped up into a frenzy over the apparent alliance between Chechen, Syrian, and Ukrainian conspirators. It was a perfect storm, calculated and set in motion by a genius. Gray liked to think that he had picked the right mentor, conveniently forgetting that it was Andrinov who had selected him. The sights, sounds, and smells of Buenos Aires brought him back to his first real field operation for Colonel Andrinov, one that took place on these very streets more than a decade before. After he'd discovered the identities of the U.S. MACV SOG recon team members operating in Laos in 1971 in the agency's files, Andrinov had asked for his help in locating the team leader. Gray's research was thorough. So much time had passed that No alarm bells went off at CIA headquarters when an analyst requested files on CIA operations in Vietnam. It was ancient history. Gray discovered that the same SEAL chief petty officer who had led R.T. Ozark on the raid that had killed a senior Soviet officer had become part of the agency's clandestine service after leaving the Navy. The man had been one of the famed Cold War operators who had dedicated his life to countering the Soviet threat. Gray could still remember his excitement at having successfully completed his first mission and could see the man's name clear as day at the top of the dossier. Thomas Reese. Oh, how the world is small. Though Tom Reese had retired from the agency, he was one of those hardcore spooks who'd never really left, and he had agreed to help with an operation in South America after 9/11. Gray had already recruited that sociopath Landry from the local embassy, and this had been his first true test of loyalty. The old spy had been wise, but age had slowed his reflexes, and the four Sicariatos, assassins from the Los Monos drug gang in Rosario, whom Landry had hired to complete the task, had the drop on him. He bled out quickly in a dark corner of the German section of the Cementerio de la Chacarita, the city's historic cemetery. Gray glanced at the stainless steel Rolex that Landry had brought him back as a trophy. Its colors faded, and edges worn smooth by decades of hard use. The death had been ruled a homicide and attributed to a robbery gone wrong, thanks in part to the theft of the very wristwatch Gray had worn ever since. He wished he'd had the courage to have done the deed himself, but he knew his limits. His weapon was his mind. It was up to Neanderthals like Landry to do the dirty work. It was only after that operation that Gray had dug deeper into the agency files and had come to appreciate its importance. The Russian officer had been Andreyanov's father, and the death of Thomas Reese, the man who'd killed him in the steaming Laotian jungle, was revenge, decades in the making. That Gray had brought such closure for Andreyanov cemented their relationship. By avenging the death of Andreyanov's father, Gray had found a father figure of his own. A father who was poised to become Russia's next leader. A president who would lead Gray's ancestral homeland back to greatness. All it would take now was patience, a virtue that was easy to embrace in the land of silver. Chapter 92. Basel, Switzerland, November. Yuri Vatutin always felt exposed on Sundays. He had warned Colonel Andreyanov more than once that his monthly church visits made him a predictable target, but the old spymaster was stubborn about the church. They could vary the 3-mile route over one of four bridges that crossed the Rhine without venturing across the borders of either France or Germany. But when leaving the compound and arriving at the church, they were completely exposed. He subconsciously tapped his left side, feeling the spare rifle magazine concealed beneath his suit jacket, the way a civilian would confirm that he was carrying his wallet. Once he'd received word from his men that the route appeared clear, he nodded to his man at the door. The front door opened, and Andreyanov walked toward the idling Mercedes with an extra spring in his step. They had been successful in putting the weak Zubarov in the ground, which had been their primary objective. Killing the President of the United States had always been a long shot. Icing on the cake, as the Americans were fond of saying. Even though he had lived, the world believed that Zubarov was assassinated by lunatic jihadis out of the Caucasus. Even NATO would have to support a Russian military response. Andreyanov's people in the Russian government were already setting the stage for the former GRU officer's return. It was only a matter of time before he would lead Russia back to greatness.